Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a new definition of accountability for public safety to include those who commit crimes, but also the systems that allow for poverty, discrimination, educational inequity, and substandard housing and health care. We'll spend this hour with lawyer and organizer Zach Norris, who says traditional strategies for dealing with crime create a divisive climate of suspicion that isolates neighbors from one another, and we spend huge amounts of money jailing offenders instead of fixing the conditions that facilitate crime and substance abuse. We'll talk about some radical fixes that have worked for communities once shattered by crime. Our conversation starts after a short break. Doctors run lab tests is to understand why we're experiencing headaches or trouble sleeping or loss of appetite. Often those complaints are symptoms of some larger underlying problem, and treating them in isolation is not likely to bring long-term relief. And yet, we tend to assume that getting tough on crime is all that's necessary to fix what ails an unsafe neighborhood, despite decades of evidence that such efforts fail to cure the broader problems of inequality. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Some experts are starting to believe that treatments like super aggressive policing and harsh sentencing can actually magnify disadvantage in struggling communities. And along with working to change that, my guest hopes to help us all shift our understanding of who and what may be ultimately responsible and to reframe our ideas about justice and accountability. Zach Norris is executive director at the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights and a co-founder of the organizations Restore Oakland and Justice for Families. His book is called We Keep Us Safe: Building Secure, Just, and Inclusive Communities. He joins us from KQED in San Francisco to talk about it. Zach, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So you introduced this book with the story of a break-in at your house, which like upset you and your wife, really terrified your daughters, which is to say you understand why people want to feel safe in their own homes. But violent crime has actually decreased in recent decades. Why are so many people still so frightened about it?
I think the thing that's important to understand is that there's a difference between crime and harm. And crime has been defined in ways that are limited and limiting, that tend to reinforce unjust status quos rather than challenging them. And so one example is that the police are often sent when workers are demanding one fair wage, when they're demanding a reasonable and living wage to break up a strike. Or the police, in my case in Oakland, in West Oakland, mothers who had decided that they wanted a home for their children. The Alameda County Sheriff's Department brought tanks, they brought submachine guns, they brought motorized drones into that home and removed those mothers and children from their home to evict them. And that, the way in which we've defined crime has been limited and limiting, and it has tended to obscure broader harms in our society that are due to poverty, increasingly due to climate change, which also hurt Black, brown, and poor communities first and worst. And we aren't really addressing those larger harms in our society. And so that is why I think, even though crime rates have been going down, our anxiety as a society is going up because these larger harms aren't being addressed. The second factor is that there are architects of anxiety, as I call them in the book, that effectively are stoking our fears, who are pointing to our neighbors, whether they be neighbors around the block, neighbors at the border, neighbors in distant lands, to say, you people are the enemy, rather than seeing that those neighbors really have a lot of the same interests that we do for our families, that they do well, that their children grow up and be successful. So this distinction between crime and harm, I think, helps to explain why anxiety is increasing in our society.
How did you start to realize that anxiety about crime may actually be anxiety about demographic change?
That is a really good question. I think being in and from Oakland, California, where we've seen so much change, gentrification, people being displaced, increasing levels of unsheltered communities, homeless people, it's really obvious that inequality is on the rise, and there's a generalized state of fear that unfortunately too many politicians are stoking rather than helping us see across divides among communities. And so being in Oakland, I think we're front and center to really seeing the ways in which demographic change can produce anxiety, both among the folks who are coming into a neighborhood in terms of seeing inequality right in your face, but also in terms of the people who are being displaced and being forced to move to faraway communities just so they can afford the rent.
So at the heart of this book is the idea that there are two ways to think about safety, right? There's a fear-based way and a care-based way. Will you explain the difference for us?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to explain the difference is just to say that in this country, we have a long history of racial injustice, a long history of gender-based violence that find their roots in slavery and the displacement of indigenous people and genocide of indigenous people. And so that ugly history is something that we often think is just in the past. But the reality is that lie that one group of people is superior to another, be they men over women or white people over people of color, that lie continues today. I call it the "he keeps us safe" lie, because it is the lie that says that one person who uses violence the most effectively is the person who will govern society and keep us safe. It is the lie of abusers, effectively, because what do abusers do? They say, don't trust the people closest to you. Don't trust your neighbor around the block. Don't trust your neighbor in a distant land. Only trust me. I will keep you safe. They blame others and they hide the real harm. So this is a lie, not just about safety. It's a lie that frankly threatens our democracy because it tends to concentrate power in one person or one group of persons in ways that are anti-democratic. By contrast, the idea that we should care for one another, that we keep us safe, is a truth that will help support democracy and support our coming together. And one quick example of that is the idea of restorative justice, where the person who's caused harm, maybe they stole a laptop, maybe they assaulted someone, the person who's been harmed, who is dealing with nightly dreams and anxieties about this event, those two people are surrounded by the folks that care for them, and an accountability plan is developed so that the person who's caused harm has to make amends, has to be held accountable. That actually helps support not just that situation to heal that harm, but also really is the building blocks for democracy because we're coming together to solve a thorny problem. So I think that when we move from this framework of fear that says that we must protect ourselves and keep away those people, if we move away from that framework of fear towards adopting a culture of care, towards supporting one another, then we'll actually achieve genuine safety.
In this book, you use the term criminal legal system in place of criminal justice system. Why is that?
It's really simple. I don't think our criminal justice system is producing justice, and I think it's more accurate to call it a criminal legal system. One example I provide in the book is when I almost lost my home. I bought a home with my father in 2005. By 2010, we were underwater, as were so many other loans across the country. We listed our race as African American. We got a subprime loan. And so we were fighting with the loan company. I ended up doing my own kind of organizing campaign with Causa Justa Just Cause, a housing rights organization, and we were able to rescue our home and get a loan modification. Now, what I know to be true is that many close family members still lost their homes. Many of my own close family members lost their homes, and it was one of the largest losses of Black wealth if not the largest loss of black wealth in the history of the country. And no one was held accountable for that, even though folks knew that these were terrible loans, that these were inflated values. This caused the Great Recession in our country, and no one was held accountable. And so, to me, an actual justice system wouldn't just bring to justice, quote unquote, the folks who are poor, tend to be persons of color, but would bring to justice the most powerful individuals as well and have them be held accountable for the harms that they cause that oftentimes are much more widespread and longer lasting as well.
Why don't tough-on-crime policies seem to extend to white-collar crime?
That's a great question. I think most fundamentally is because we have a system that perpetuates wealth and inequality rather than undoing it. And I think until we begin to really provide some of the fundaments to make it possible for everyone to really participate in our democracy, we are going to continue to see a justice system that is as lopsided as the democracy itself, that is continuing to exclude people from the franchise up to this day in 2020. Because if you can label someone as undeserving of rehabilitation, as undeserving of redemption, then it's also easy to label them as undeserving of our democratic rights. And those things actually started in tandem, if you look at the history of this country in terms of the black codes that moved people from slavery back onto plantations and also forbade them from being able to exercise the franchise. So those things were historically linked and continue to be linked based on this framework of fear that our justice system operates under.
So, Zach, if tough on crime is sort of the apex of the fear-based safety system, what kinds of things are included in a care-based safety system that require accountability?
Yeah, a care-based safety system really starts with the understanding that public health issues must be addressed with public health solutions. So if I'm talking about drug use and abuse, school discipline, unsheltered or homelessness, if I'm talking about those issues that are really public health issues, we should be addressing them with public health solutions. The thing that I think gets lost in terms of our dialogue about public safety is actually the public, because we think, and the basic premise of my book is that we can't take care of public safety until we take care of the public. And so there is a baseline level of supporting folks who are dealing with drug use and abuse, who have mental health crises, who are seeing the growing anxiety around them and self-medicating at points. We need to deal with those public health issues with a public health lens. And I think it's entirely possible that we do so.
Who benefits from amplifying our fears about crime?
In the book, I call them the architects of anxiety. They are often politicians, but they're also corporations that benefit from a justice system that is unjust and that continues to profit off of cycles of poverty and incarceration. And so when a politician can stoke fears and create a divide amongst communities and exclude certain voters from reaching the polls, that can benefit their reelection prospects. And we see that happening right now at the national level. And I think that there's an opportunity to really expose that lie. But first, we have to get beyond the fear. And I think that's why this book is important, because we've had people, you know, say to each other, you know, don't listen to this argument. You know, you're really better off with going with our program that supports your economic interests, but they're not really speaking to the underlying fears that people are responding to. And so what I'm trying to put forward with this book is that we keep us safe. So often, you know, our entire dialogue around safety has been dominated by prisons. So when you hear the term public safety, you might think of handcuffs and prisons and bars and guards. But if I ask you to think of a time
when
you
felt safe...
Let
me jump in, Zach. I'm sorry. I need to take a break here. My guest is Zach Morris. His book is We Keep Us Safe. We'll be back in just a minute. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Zach Norris, who's executive director at the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights and author of a new book called We Keep Us Safe, Building Secure, Just, and Inclusive Communities. Before the break, Zach, you were talking about the fact that some leaders sort of appeal to the idea that by serving individual economic interests, people will eventually be okay and sort of obtain their safety that way.
Yeah, and just this idea that... we can overcome people's fears by talking about and making the leap to economic security while not really addressing the ways in which fears are stoked by certain politicians. And so I think we have to remind people what it actually feels like to feel safe in this, in these days and times. And so when I ask people, you know, think of a time when you felt safe. Oftentimes people will say, well, I'm with my mom, I'm with my grandmother, I'm at my church or my mosque, I'm with community. So safety is really closely associated with relationship and community, but our public safety systems are really closely associated with disconnecting people from community and relationship under the guise of punishing them. But we are, as a society, punished ourselves as a result of that, because people come back home worse off than they went in to prison, and it's tending to reinforce cycles of poverty and incarceration rather than undoing them. So we need to move to an entirely different mode of thinking about safety itself.
How can we put current fears about mass shootings into context, given all the other harms that affect people in this country right now?
I think that's a great question. One of the things that I would want to point your listeners to is Richmond, California. In 2005, Richmond, California had one of the highest homicide rates in the country. The city was up in arms about what to do. They declared a state of emergency. The police had actually identified 30 persons who they believed were responsible for 70% of the shootings in the city. But they couldn't make the case, and meaning they couldn't bring the evidence necessary to convict these folks. And Devon Bogan came to Richmond with an idea of starting a mentorship program that would involve and engage these young men who were responsible or believed to be responsible for homicides in the city of Richmond. And there was a lot of skepticism, Chris, about this program. You know, people said, wait, you're going to pay people a monthly stipend not to shoot each other? Why do they get travel opportunities? And are they really deserving of this daily positive mentorship? But those were the three things that he wanted to ensure happened, that each young man got a monthly stipend, daily positive mentorship, and that they were provided with travel opportunities to kind of expand their horizons. And as they got that support, the walls between them broke down across rival neighborhoods and their whole world opened up. And people will say, well, is that fair? I'm not sure. I think it's fair for the city because of the results, if nothing else. And I think it's fair to treat every person with humanity. The results were that the crime rate and the homicide rate dropped by 70% within the city of Richmond over an 8-year period. And that meant a victory, not just for those young men, but also a victory for mothers and grandmothers who wanted to bring their kids to the park, for shop owners who wanted to keep their businesses open a few hours longer to invite more patrons. It meant a victory for the city of Richmond as a whole, whose economic base grew during that same period. So I think that when we talk about gun violence in the city, in cities and towns across the country, if we're not talking about the work of Devon Bogan and Advance Peace, the work of Pastor Mike McBride at Live Free, we haven't really understood what the issues are, nor really taken the steps we need to address them.
So I was drawn to this book because it's full of ideas that sound seem to run counter to the things we've been told are just true about crime and punishment and public safety. Mm-hmm. Why do you think the see something, say something ethos ultimately may do more harm than good?
Yeah, every year we host an event that we call Night Out for Safety and Liberation. About 30 cities this past year participated. And it's kind of a counterpoint to National Night Out. And National Night Out is an event where the police and community members come out to reclaim safety. And I think that's a great thing. But the challenge is that the police often lead with a narrative of you're the eyes and ears of the police. And if you see something, say something, right? But respectfully, I think community members have more than eyes and ears. We have hearts, we have hands, we have minds. There are many ways that people can contribute to community safety. When you are mentoring a young person, you are contributing to community safety. If you're providing a job to a formerly incarcerated person, you're contributing to community safety. If you are engaging with your neighbors and understanding them, not just as potential suspects, but as folks that you want to support as part of a community, then you're enhancing community safety. And I think what we saw is that this idea of suspicion, this idea of if you see something, say something, can go really awry. The murder of Trayvon Martin by a neighborhood watch captain, George Zimmerman, is actually why we started Night Out for Safety and Liberation. That was kind of the impetus behind it. And so I think that it can very quickly go off the deep end and tends to reinforce a dynamic of suspicion and surveillance, which is key to this framework of fear that I think we need to move away from.
All right, let's go on the phones to Maggie in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Maggie.
Perfect segue, as usual. And this is another book I'll be buying.
Thank you, Maggie.
In the 90s, that whole neighborhood watch became very popular, but what we tended to do, I live in Fort Worth, and I was in a mixed-race neighborhood, a really long block, and we did a party once a year, closed off the street, and we actually knew our neighbors. And it meant that if you were driving down the street and something unusual was happening at someone's house, you recognized it because you knew who lived there and what they were doing.
That's right.
That seems to have fallen by the wayside. Is something like that something that should be revived or in a new iteration? How would you recommend that?
Thanks for calling.
I think absolutely. You know, it was Jane Addams who talked about eyes on the street and the way in which, you know, in communities, it's a grandmother or a mother who's kind of watching out for kids and who's letting them know and their parents know if they think someone's in trouble or getting in trouble. That kind of really seeing each other rather than watching each other, I think, is the ethos that we need to adopt. And I think, you know, to be clear, it would also support police officers because police officers are now responsible for responding in the event of mental health crises. They're responding in the event of drug use and abuse. They're responding in school discipline cases in ways that I don't think are germane to their skills. Their scope should be limited. And I think as neighbors, as community guardians are really stepping in as nurses and people who are trained to de-escalate situations, then we will actually increase community safety. So I think you're entirely right that we do need to continue to have these night outs, but we do need to challenge the idea that we're just kind of watching each other and really understand that it takes the building of community to really create safety.
We're so accustomed to punishment being like a primary aspect of public safety efforts in this country that it doesn't occur to most of us to ask whether that is the best way to handle violations of the law. How does what you call a punishment society, which I gather is what we have right now, create incentives for militarizing police forces?
Yeah, I mean, look, the history of this country is a history of frontier justice. And I do think that we have a cultural work to do. We think about the pace and the level of technological change, the advance of transportation, and the ways in which our society has advanced in so many different directions, many of them positive. But our justice system, I think, was more advanced prior to the inception of this country than it is in 2020. When we had indigenous brothers and sisters were doing restorative justice, they were holding people accountable while still holding them in community. They were resolving harm in ways that I think are much more advanced than this kind of pound of flesh notion that we have of justice that ends up hurting us. Because when, you know, someone goes to prison and they come back and they haven't been served and their mental health crises have worsened, it can lead to tragedy. One of the really tragic stories I talk about is Marlena Henderson, who knew her brother was deteriorating each time he went in and out of prison from being a youth, and he ended up coming out of prison and killing both of their parents. And one of the things I describe in the book is, what are all the different interventions that were possible for James to avoid this tragedy? And I think it's something that we should all pay attention to, because it's in our benefit in terms of our own safety.
And if I remember correctly from the book, James wasn't simply someone who had lost his way. He had a diagnosed mental illness.
That's true. That's absolutely true. And Marlena had been reaching out to the sheriff's department, to law enforcement, and each time she did, what she heard was, well, we can't really do anything until he's actually involved in an incident. And each time she thought to herself, well, it's going to be too late by then. And tragically, her parents were murdered. I think that, you know, had he been able to be involved in this program in Santa Cruz, California, called the MOST program, that supported folks with mental health crises, he would have been so much better, and, you know, potentially that tragedy could have been avoided. Unfortunately, that program wasn't being resourced at the level that it should, and tragedy ensued. And so, you know, I think there are opportunities for us not to be tough on crime, but to be smart on crime, to make the reasonable investments in public health approaches that will keep all of us safer.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So when a young person, a minor according to the law, breaks the law, what is the assumption about the role that young person's parents can play in their development?
That's a really great question also. You know, what I've seen is that too often families are viewed as pariahs rather than partners. They are viewed as part of the problem rather than part of the solution. And I know that from experience. When I got out of law school as an organizer, I sat around a table with about 6 to 8 parents, and they described to me the conditions inside of California Youth Authority youth prisons, that young people were being isolated for 23 hours a day, that, you know, families were traveling hours upon hours to visit their loved ones. And often they were being told once they got there, you can't visit because you have on the wrong color pair of pants, or you have underwire in your bra, or your kid's entire housing unit is on lockdown and on solitary confinement. So rather than seeing, you know, rehabilitation, the critical importance of young people having a community to support them when they come home, these parents and grandparents were being excluded from the rehabilitation process. So what we were able to do is really demonstrate that families were trying desperately to support their kids and convince lawmakers the same. And we were able to pass some legislation that made it easier for families to stay in contact. Unfortunately, you know, that's kind of the status quo across the country, that families are excluded. But I think we know that people come back to their communities. And so actually supporting that support system is just in all of our interest. And we need to change the way we think of families and communities so that that is the case.
So zero tolerance policies in schools were sold to all of us as a way to nip bad behavior in the bud, right? So that school kids who break rules don't become adults who break laws. How have those policies turned out in practice? Do they work?
They don't work. They absolutely do not work. Zero tolerance doesn't work for adolescents because adolescents are supposed to engage in risky behavior. That is actually what you are supposed to do as an adolescent. That is part of a normal maturation process, a normal process of maturing. And at my Catholic school where I went to, we were involved in different things like ropes courses where you did a trust fall or you did a giant's ladder where you had to climb this giant ladder and you were on belay, which means, you know, if you fell, someone would catch you. So we were involved in positive risk-taking behavior to support us as adolescents because that's what adolescents do. Unfortunately, when we treat young people with zero tolerance, we bring them into systems that are the number one predictors to adult incarceration. So you might think we're going to be zero tolerant with you as a young person and so you won't go into adult prison, but actually the research shows that the number one predictor for adult incarceration is youth incarceration, is involvement with the juvenile justice system. And further, it shows that if you take young people, a cohort of young people, and do absolutely nothing for them, versus a cohort of young people who you involve in the juvenile justice system, the cohort of young people who you do absolutely nothing for will turn out better than the young people who go through the juvenile justice system. And so we should actually be reminded that young people make mistakes, that their brains are still developing, and act accordingly and not have zero tolerance, but have increased tolerance for young people's risk-taking behavior and support them in taking the kinds of risks and providing the kinds of opportunities that will support their, you know, normal process of maturing.
Zach Norris is executive director at the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights and a co-founder of Restore Oakland and Justice for Families. His book is called We Keep Us Safe, Building Secure, Just, and Inclusive Communities. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Zach Norris, executive director at the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights and author of We Keep Us Safe, Building Secure, Just, and Inclusive Communities. Zach, inevitably when we have a conversation like this one that touches on things like less punitive criminal justice or jail diversion or clemency for young offenders, we hear from people who say, it sounds as if you care about more about people who have broken the rules, broken the laws than about victims. And I want to be clear that that's not the case for you. Can you sort of explain restorative justice to us and how it seeks to also compensate people who've been harmed?
Yeah, I mean, there's this notion that being tough on crime is removing someone from a community and putting them in a prison cell. But I think the reality is that what is really hardcore is people being forced to face the harm that they have caused, to sit down in front of the person that they have harmed, to understand the way in which it's caused harm, the nightmares, all of the panic, all of the associated harms that have come with, you know, someone assaulting someone or worse, and to understand that and to actually have to make amends and be accountable for it. And so what people don't understand about restorative justice is that victims, survivors of crime, report much higher satisfaction rates with restorative justice. There's this notion that has been produced that victims only support longer and longer sentences, but entities and organizations like Californians for Safety and Justice, and among other networks of survivors of crime, are putting that myth to bed. And they are saying, we want this process where we see the accountability that has occurred, where we are paid back through the actions of this individual, and we understand that they are no longer going to commit similar acts in the future. So restorative justice is one of the true win-wins because it actually reduces the recidivism rates of those who have caused harm, meaning they're less likely to get back in trouble again, and victims report much higher satisfaction rates with the process. So to the folks who say, you know, this isn't tougher on crime, I would say that this is actually hardcore. This is real accountability. And I think this is what this country needs. And I hope that it can be an example of the kinds of accountability that we also need to bring to larger institutional actors who have also caused real harms in our communities.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Steve is on the line in Carrollton, Texas. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. You know, I think that it seems like until we get to the root of the matter here with this problem, we're really just going to be fixing all the symptoms. Because when you look at statistics, you know, you see it's the one thing that emerges crystally clear is the connection between intact families and success, and that's measured in every metric, life expectancy, the whole gamut. But when are we going to recognize the significance of the family?
What about that, Zach?
Yeah, I think that your caller has a great point, that intact families and supportive families are critical to people doing well. And the problem is that in this country, we have a history of family separation, a history of demonizing individuals and very intentionally disconnecting them from their support network. So one example is this idea of the youth super predator that was really propagated and pushed out in the 90s that said that there was going to be this coming youth crime wave, black and brown youth. The numbers are increasing. And as a result of that, we invested in this fear framework. There were millions of dollars doled out to counties across the country, municipalities across the country to increase the incarceration of young people, even at the same time that youth crime was declining. And so when we don't actually respect the sanctity of families, when we begin to isolate young people from their families and kind of demonize them through some of these racist tropes, then we actually undermine families. And so a big part of what I call for in the book is let's actually see each other and understand that all families want the same things and begin to support families who are navigating poverty and who want to support their kids but maybe don't have the wherewithal to be working three jobs and paying as much attention to their children as they would like to.
So you were a kid in Oakland in the 90s. Did you look around and wonder where all the super predators were?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I noticed is that once I got to Harvard as an undergrad, that young people were treated so much differently for doing similar things. Huh. You know, if you had a drug problem or if you got into a fight at the gymnasium, that meant you got mental health counseling or drug treatment. Maybe at worst you got a semester off and you came back to resume your studies. And folks in my neighborhood were getting jail time for doing similar things. And I believe that we can do better, that each of us is more than our worst mistake, as one of my mentors, Brian Stevenson, says. And that when we recognize that, we will see not broken families, we will see families that are striving to be whole and support them.
So earlier in this hour, you mentioned the challenges of unsheltered people. Some people use the term homeless. Recently, we've heard reports about cities around the country outlawing certain behaviors that are common among people who don't have homes, right? They're camping in parks or in other public places. They're, for lack of a better word, loitering because they don't have any place to go home to. None of these laws change the fact that people don't have shelter.
Right.
What do we do about this?
Well, I'm glad that the Supreme Court has weighed in on this in a case called Boise versus Idaho that says that if you're not providing a shelter, if you're not providing access to a shelter within a city, you shouldn't be propagating and moving forward these laws that basically criminalize a status. So if I don't have a home and I'm trying to find a place to bathe and you're outlawing bathing, you're criminalizing my status as a poor person, and that instead of continuing to spend resources on cycles of jailing and then people coming out without a home and then jailing them again and the cycle continuing, we should actually do what is more cost effective and more humane, which is provide people with homes. And this kind of housing first solution is what cities across the country should be adopting, although they've been too slow to do so, unfortunately.
I'm curious about your opinion with regard to the word deserve, because sometimes we use it to say people who've done bad things deserve punishment. Other times we feel like people who've done good things or follow the rules deserve rewards. How does the term deserve get applied in America?
It gets applied in a very money-focused way. It gets applied in a way that doesn't sufficiently recognize our inherent dignity as human beings. And I think as the executive director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, one of the things that I advocate for is an understanding that each of us has inalienable rights as human beings that should be respected. I think that when we start to respect those rights, our problems will begin to dissipate. Our safety will increase. Our prosperity will increase. And I think that we can do it. One of the problems is that we have been governed by this framework of fear. But another problem is that we just haven't seen visible, tangible examples of what community safety looks like when it's really oriented around the needs of community members. And I'd love to provide you with one example, if that's okay.
Sure.
Yeah, so, you know, we have, you know, politicians of all stripes saying they're for criminal justice reform, that they recognize that there's cycles of poverty and incarceration, but too often they're focused just on reducing incarceration rather than building the kind of community safety examples that we need. And people's ideas have been governed by programs like Law and Order and Cops and some of these television shows that really crowd out the public imagination. And so recognizing that in Oakland, we decided to create a new center that we call Restore Oakland. On the first floor will be a restaurant run by formerly incarcerated folks and others who have been locked out of opportunity. On the second floor, there'll be a dedicated space for restorative justice so people can be held accountable and yet still held in community. And there'll be a lot of good civic engagement of people within the space to really encourage their politicians to really understand that this is the vision of safety that we need. When people have good jobs, when they can be held accountable and yet actually allow the opportunity to heal the harms that they have caused, that is what will produce greater safety. And so we have this very brick and mortar, tangible example of what community safety looks like. It's 18,000 square feet. It's a building. You can see it. You can touch it. Unfortunately, not everybody's going to come to Oakland. Not everybody, even in Oakland, will come through the space. And so that's why I wrote this book called We Keep Us Safe, because I want people to know about these kinds of examples that are present across the country, but haven't really been brought to scale and should be for the safety of all of us.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You say that the current administration, the Trump administration, has made us versus them into national policy. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think when you run on the politics of, you know, Mexican people are drug dealers and rapists and are scapegoating and creating fear around entire groups of people, you are labeling them as the other. You are creating them as a category of persons who aren't worthy of the kinds of human dignity and respect that all of us should have. You are creating the conditions that will allow for their family disintegration at the border when they arrive and through other policies. And then people turn and say, well, look at all the broken homes and broken families. Well, those homes were broken. They were smashed. And that politics of us versus them, I think, leads to greater anxiety. It leads to greater insecurity. And it isn't supportive of the kind of society that I think all of us should aspire to, where we all are taken care of and where we can see each other and support each other as neighbors.
Do you have numbers that show the sort of track record of restorative justice is better on recidivism than incarceration?
Yeah, our numbers show that recidivism rates are cut roughly in half when you adopt a restorative justice approach. So people are half as likely to engage in further criminal behavior, to be rearrested when going through a restorative justice process rather than going through the criminal court system. So I think those numbers are great. I think that we should be investing in restorative justice, but also investing in a public health response to public health issues so that many of the things that frankly should not be treated with a criminal justice hammer instead should be dealt with as the public health issues they are. When we bring those things together, the restorative justice with the public health responses, I think we'll much more quickly achieve greater safety.
Assuming that society can agree that there is a certain subset of people that is too dangerous or too damaged to sort of qualify for restorative justice, what rights should they have while they're being held in government custody?
Yeah, when people are incarcerated, they should be treated with dignity. They should be treated with respect. They should be treated with an understanding that they are capable of redemption. And so that's one reason I don't believe in the death penalty or life without parole, in addition to the, you know, grave errors that are present with the death penalty that were highlighted through the film Just Mercy, that 1 in 10 people are innocent, something along those lines. So I think that we should treat every single person with dignity and with respect so that when they return to communities, they are in a better position to provide mentorship to young people, to be an asset to their community, which is a benefit to all of us and a benefit to public safety.
Zach Norris is executive director at the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights and a co-founder of the organizations Restore Oakland and Justice for Families. His new book is called We Keep Us Safe, Building Secure, Just, and Inclusive Communities. Zach, thank you very much for making time to spend with us this afternoon.
Really appreciate it.
You can follow us on Facebook and also on Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. You can download the Think podcast and subscribe to the Think podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or you can listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.